Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit DartmouthHitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. When you cast a ballot in a presidential primary, you're voting for the person you want to be president, right? Well, yes, but indirectly so, through designated representatives of your wishes, people called delegates. These folks gather at their party's national conventions after all the primaries and caucuses are over and nominate their standard bearers. But while the vast majority of delegates must follow the will of the people, that's not the case with all of them. This is especially true on the Democratic side, with its more than 700 superdelegates, many of whom technically can vote for whoever they want, although in practice, almost no one does this. Still, when there's a hot contest on the Democratic side like there is this year, this system raises concerns. And there's also a delegate dilemma on the Republican side, albeit much smaller. About 160 Republican National Committee members can, in theory, vote for their own presidential choice. And in New Hampshire, there's another twist called a 10% threshold, whereby the popular vote winner not only gets his or her duly won delegates, the winner also scoops up the tallies of candidates who receive less than 10% support. That threshold is even higher in many other states. Today in The Exchange, the dust-up over delegates. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. Chris Galdieri is here in studio, assistant professor of politics at St. Anselm College, specializing in presidential politics. And Chris, thank you for being here.
Happy to be here, Laura.
Joining us from the D.C. area, Ken Rudin, host of The Political Junkie, a weekly radio show covering national, state, and local politics. He's an expert in U.S. politics and campaign history. You can find Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And Ken Rudin, welcome back.
Good morning, Laura.
And also joining us from D.C., Daniel Strauss, 2016 campaign reporter for Politico. He's also a former breaking news reporter for The Hill newspaper. And Daniel Strauss, good to have you, too. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, to you first, I think, Chris Galdieri, why can't we just vote for president? Why do we have to vote for delegates?
Well, I think it's important to understand that the current system is essentially trying to graft a role for the party rank-and-file members onto a system that was never designed with them in mind. For a very long time, from about 1832 up through 1968, conventions and most of the delegates to them did the deciding themselves. Primaries tended not to choose delegates. Every state didn't have a primary. Most of them were beauty contests where you would run not to win delegates but to demonstrate your appeal to party insiders. So the classic example of this would be John F. Kennedy. As a Catholic, a lot of people worried about his electability, so he picked the West Virginia primary, the most Protestant state in the country at that time, to show people in the Democratic Party that he could win Protestant votes. Since then, there were a series of reforms that the Democrats instituted after 1968. And essentially every state now has a primary or a caucus. And so we don't vote directly for people because the parties are still trying to work with that convention structure and have voters choose delegates rather than simply having party insiders or party bosses choose the delegates.
Okay, that
themselves.
Sounds really old-fashioned, Chris, that we're still, you know, hanging on to for some reason mm-hmm. this, I don't know, mossy vestige from the past. I mean, who needs these people?
Well, I think it's important to remember that nobody really designed this process. The modern process just sort of happened by accident. When the Democrats reformed the system after 1968 with the McGovern-Fraser Commission, they didn't necessarily expect that there would be primaries and caucuses. It's just that states figured that was the easiest way for them to comply with these new rules. So it is, you know, it's an old-fashioned system with some modern stuff added on top of it, and then you know, whenever parties are going through a rough patch in terms of winning presidential elections, they tend to add something else to it. So, for instance, that's why we have superdelegates. The Democrats reacted in the other direction after George McGovern and Jimmy Carter and thought, OK, we need party insiders to have more of a role.
Party insiders.
Yes.
To have more of a role. And that's what people are fighting about now.
Exactly.
And we're going to talk this hour not just about the superdelegate question, which I know is fresh on everybody's minds, but the whole delegate question more broadly. And this always comes up also with the electoral college counts and so forth. Ken Rudin, I'd love your thoughts, too. Why can't I just walk into the, you know, the polling place here in New Hampshire and vote for who I want for president?
Well, you can, but lots of luck with that because, I mean, as Chris says, obviously there are so many different steps and processes you have to go. But the thought of a convention mattering anymore, look, I mean, once upon a time, and before this primary system, which really began in 1972, once upon a time, the nominees were decided at a convention. The famous story of Adlai Stevenson in 1952, he walks into the Chicago convention as a non-candidate and walks out as the nominee.
Really?
Once upon a time, those decisions, once upon a time, these decisions were made at the convention. But, you know, as Chris points out, that this was the party bosses, not the people. And then, of course, so we saw the perfect example in 1968, when Hubert Humphrey didn't win a single primary, and yet he was the Democratic nominee for president. And everybody said, okay, this is just taking the party bosses too far. So George McGovern and these kids, these long-haired kids, took over the Democratic Party in 1972, kicked out the adults like Mayor Daley in the name of democracy. And it was a great victory for the small d Democratic process. And George McGovern wound up losing 49 out of 50 states. So ultimately, some kind of semblance of order needed to be brought back into the process by the Democratic elders, and that's what brought on these superdelegates.
Order, but defined by sort of the gray hairs, Ken, if I could put it that way?
Well, yes, absolutely, because we gave those kids a chance. They showed us what George McGovern did. We saw this outsider, Jimmy Carter, in 1976, and yes, he won, although despite the wishes of the party bosses. And then in 1980, he suffered a landslide defeat to Ronald Reagan. So after the 1980 election, they said that the gray hair said, okay, no more McGoverns, no more Jimmy Carters. Let's have these people who have a vested interest in the Democratic Party play a major role in deciding who the nominee is, or at least keeping things in line. We want a winner. We want somebody who could unite the party. And thus came to be these superdelegates.
Very interesting. And Daniel Strauss, you're covering the Sanders campaign right now, although you've been covering a lot of campaigns this year. What jumps out at you as in times past, Daniel? And then we'll talk about right now for sure. But what about in the past, Daniel? When has this whole delegate-based system really been highlighted?
I think it's been highlighted most now, actually. I can't
really
remember in the last few election cycles that I have covered. Of course, in 2012, I was on the GOP side, and delegates weren't really a huge issue. But I'd say that right now, the issue is, or the topic is, the most up front and center of all the ones that I can remember. And partially this is just because Sanders supporters suddenly woke up after the New Hampshire and Iowa primaries, or the Iowa caucus, and said, well, wait a minute, like, our victories were good, but we have a longer way to go than we thought. And I think that's why, going forward, you're seeing some movement among Sanders supporters in the Democratic grassroots.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that, Daniel. And as you said, there's a lot of consternation on the part of Bernie Sanders supporters over the superdelegates that Clinton has, even with Senator Sanders' huge margin of victory here in New Hampshire. How concerned should Sanders supporters be, Daniel, about this, given the history of what superdelegates have done in the past?
I mean, well, actually, given the history, there should be some optimism, right? So in the 08 election, when Hillary Clinton started out as the front runner then, and President Obama was running this upstart outsider campaign, he was short on superdelegates, too. And by the end, he enjoyed a large amount of defections. But it's something that Sanders supporters are thinking right now, well, we need to start paying attention to this if we want to actually seriously get our guy elect to win the nomination and even to the White House.
Chris Galdieri, you wrote about 2008 when this came up as well.
I did. And what we found there was that in advance of the beginning of the voting, you had a fair number of superdelegates who came out for Hillary Clinton. Yes, but it was a much smaller proportion of them then. And you had a few who would come out for Barack Obama. But we found that my co-authors and I looked at this. We looked at the timing of when these decisions were made. Once the voting began, people stopped coming out for Clinton the way they had before voting started, and they slowly started to come out for Obama. And then over the course of the entire primary season, more and more were coming out for Obama. So I think for the most part, superdelegates, I mean, a lot of them are politicians. They all want their party to win. It's not in their interest to come right out and say, you know, oh, my gosh, we think this Bernie Sanders guy can't win, or we don't think Obama can win. So even though people in my state are for him, I'm going to come out against him. I think they tend to be aware of what's going on in their states. They're aware of who's polling well. And, you know, I think they're more trying to nudge people more than anything else rather than try to, you know, wrench the nomination away from someone.
Well, here's a Facebook comment from Liz who says, the superdelegate situation is giving me pause. Liz says, although I don't affiliate with a party anymore, I try hard to encourage folks that our votes do matter. But Liz says it's getting difficult to get past those superdelegates. She asks, what's the history/rationale of the superdelegates, which you guys have already talked about. Mm-hmm. But then, Ken, here's the second part of her question. She says, how have they affected election results? What do you think, Ken?
Well, the only time they may have had an effect is, look, they were instituted in 1982, and in 1984, Walter Mondale was the clear national choice of the party insiders, and so many of the superdelegates went to Walter Mondale, even though ultimately he also lost 49 states to Ronald Reagan. But he was the clear establishment choice as opposed to Gary Hart and Jesse Jackson. What's interesting about this case is that, you know, as Daniel points out correctly, in 2008, the Obama people were saying the exact same thing the Bernie Sanders people are saying now, that the establishment is going to take the nomination away from us. It's a rigged system. And we've seen this in 2016 as well. You know, the fact that many of the Democratic debates were at 4 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday morning, and you could only get it on the Glockenspiel channel if you had that cable system. And they say it's rigged against us. So here we have Bernie Sanders winning 60% of the vote in New Hampshire, winning by 22 percentage points, and yet he should win a clear majority of the delegates. But when you have 6 of the 8 Democratic superdelegates already deciding that Hillary Clinton is their choice, basically they came out of New Hampshire with a tie, and so they're saying, oh no, this system is rigged against us. But as we've said earlier in the show, ultimately, if Bernie Sanders wins primaries and caucuses, as Barack Obama did in 2008, these superdelegates, I suspect, will not be a factor in deciding who the nominee will be.
Well, and Daniel, so to you then, you've been tracking, you know, the growing number of online petitions, people who are very upset about this, urging superdelegates to abide by the will of the voters. But as people have been fleshing out the history and how this works in practice, not just in political theory, has that upset calmed down or does it continue to grow?
Well, it's still new, but so I think the only direction is upwards. But I think it's over the past week or so, it's grown, maybe not exponentially, but noticeably. MoveOn.org, the liberal grassroots organization, is trying to foster that. They polled their supporters over the weekend, and part of their plan on this was to target undecided superdelegates this week on to make a decision. And, you know, if MoveOn had its way, back Bernie.
Well, here's another Facebook comment from Angela, who says these superdelegates are the party's way of stacking the deck for their favored candidate. Angela says, I think it's sleazy and undemocratic. And then Gary from Sugar Hill sent in an email. He says, superdelegates can manipulate the nomination process in a close race and potentially overturn the will of the people. Gary says, it feels like old backroom politics to me. As a country, we are better than this. If the delegate count is close and superdelegates, 712 in all, overrule the will of the people, they should each be required to explain to the public why democracy does not matter to them. Thank you, Gary, for the email and Angela for the Facebook comment. So, Daniel, to you again, how likely is it that these superdelegates would, quote unquote, according to Gary, overturn the will of the people?
It depends on the results of the next few primary and caucus battles. Hillary Clinton is still the favorite to win the nomination, but we're at a point in the cycle in this campaign where Sanders is not something that Clinton can ignore anymore. And I think you will see more superdelegates going to Sanders if he continues to perform extremely well in primaries and caucuses.
And Daniel, last question for you, please. Is there a point at which these superdelegates have to publicly say who they'll support, or can they wait until convention day?
I think they can wait until convention day. I'm a little worried in saying this because it sounds like my counterparts here probably know better than I can. But they have time, is the short answer.
Well, Daniel, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it. And good luck on the campaign trail.
Thanks for having me.
That's Daniel Strauss, 2016 campaign reporter for Politico. You can join us today in the exchange as we try to figure out this delegate situation, not just the superdelegates on the Democratic side, but there are all sorts of other delegate rules at play here with both parties. Join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Again, you can send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. And Ken Rudin, going back to that email that I just read from Gary, you know, again, saying if the delegate count is close and superdelegates overrule the will of the people, they should be required to explain to the public why democracy does not matter to them. These superdelegates feel, we've heard this from so many listeners, very undemocratic. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I agree with the concern. I understand the concerns completely, and both Angela and Gary raised very important points. I mean, if I were a Bernie Sanders supporter, and I see that we have a tie game in Iowa and an overwhelming victory in New Hampshire, and then I look at the superdelegates who have committed so far, 394 have committed to Hillary Clinton, 42 have committed to Bernie Sanders. They say, well, wait a second, the game is rigged. But we have to point out, and by the way, in answer to your earlier question, yes, these superdelegates could wait until the convention to make their announcement. But not since 1980 has there been any doubt about who the Democratic nominee will be once they got to the convention. In 1980, it was Kennedy and Carter, and there were a lot of back and forths between, you know, pledged delegates and superdelegates and things like that, and who's supporting whom. But right now, I mean, as somebody pointed out, and I think Ray Buckley, the chairman of the Democratic Party, will say, look, yes, Hillary Clinton won the primary in 2008 in New Hampshire, clearly. But by the time we got to the convention in Denver, the entire delegation was behind Barack Obama. So if there is a close battle for the nomination come convention time, then obviously these delegates will play a major, major role. But right now, if we, you know, if history is prologue, then basically we'll see, let the primaries and caucus process play itself out, and then we'll worry about the role the superdelegates play.
Yeah, so it is still early. Chris, go ahead.
Very early.
Yeah, I agree. I think the one situation where I could see the superdelegates making a difference would be if it was essentially a tiebreaker sort of situation. But the difference, I think, between this and the, you know, legendary smoke-filled rooms of you know, back in the day, is that we know who these people are. We have a list of their names. We know what their jobs are. Exactly.
Gene Shaheen, so Maggie Hassan.
If people do have an issue with superdelegates, they can keep that in mind when these people are up for election. They can, you know, tweet at them. They can go to their town hall meetings. So at the very least, if you do have a situation where superdelegates make the difference, we know who they are, and they probably will. You know, they might not get up and say, this is why I don't believe in democracy, but they probably will give some sort of an explanation as to why they're making the decision they are.
To use Gary's words.
Exactly.
So again, these superdelegates, Chris, they are politicians in their own right, and they need to stand before the people. So it's unlikely, it's possible, but it's unlikely that they would ultimately go against the will.
Exactly. And they want to win elections. And if they see a candidate is, you know, clobbering Hillary Clinton in the primaries, they're going to keep that in mind when they finally vote at the convention.
All right. There's a lot more to untangle after a short break, including some delegate issues on the Republican side. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a primer on the presidential nominating process, especially the issue around delegates. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. Find us on Twitter. My guest for the hour, Ken Rudin, host of The Political Junkie, a weekly radio show covering national, state, and local politics. You can find him at krpoliticaljunkie.com. With me in studio, Chris Galdieri, assistant professor of politics at St. Anselm College, specializing in presidential politics. And gentlemen, one more question for you, and then we are going to go to Jennifer Horn, chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party. Ken, why does the Democratic Party have superdelegates and the Republicans do not?
Well, the Republicans do in a way because every state has a state party chair and then a Republican National Committee man and a National Republican Committee woman. So every state has those three superdelegates and they are automatic delegates. But again, Republicans have never suffered the kind of intra-party problems that the Democrats, as we saw in 1968. So that's why the Democrats put all these governors, senators, members of Congress, big city mayors, party and local officials as super delegates to basically correct and protect the system from the outsiders, where for the most part, the Republican Party has never been taken over by outsiders. Of course, that this is in the pre-Donald Trump era.
Yeah, what do you think, Chris?
Well, and I also think it goes back to the fact that at the same time the Democrats were making these changes to their rules, Republicans were very happy with the nominees they were getting. They were nominating Ronald Reagan and the first George Bush and then, you know, people like Bob Dole and George W. Bush. So they never felt like these outsiders had come in and upended the process and saddled them with an unpopular candidate who either lost 49 states or was a, you know, had a really troubled one-term presidency and then took the party down with him at re-election. And it's only when parties are, you know, in a bad patch that they decide, okay, we need to do something about the way we pick our candidates.
Okay, and there's been some discussion about this now on the Republican side, given the many issues surrounding all those candidates competing and Donald Trump, the outsider, and so forth. Well, and we have Jennifer Horn with us now on the phone, again, chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party. And Jennifer Horn, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you so much, Laura. It's a pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity.
So there's been a lot of focus on these Democratic superdelegates, but Republican National Committee members, about 160 of them, can also vote for whoever they want, a small number. But has this ever come up, Jennifer, as a point of contention?
Well, actually, I, with all due respect to your guests, I have to correct them because that's actually not the case. There are 168 members of the Republican National Committee. And as he indicated, Chairman, National Committee Man, National Committee Woman, and then, you know, U.S. Virgin Islands and Guam and some of the other areas that come in. So we have 168 of us. None of them are superdelegates. All of the delegates are, it is figured out under Rule 16 in advance how those delegates will be apportioned through the states. Winner take all, or here in New Hampshire, we're a proportional state. So the National Committee Man, National Committee Woman, and myself, we don't get to just support whomever we please.
I see.
We will be, we call us at-large delegates. We will be assigned proportionally as per the Secretary of State.
In your own particular state. Okay, so those, again, small number, 168 of you, cannot vote for whoever you want. All right.
No.
Well, I did want to ask you about,
And just to be exactly clear, each state has had to, we refer to Rule 16. It's Rule 16 under the RNC rules. Each state had to submit a plan in advance to the RNC as to how all of our delegates were going to be, you know, apportioned. So I don't know the exact language in every single state across the country, but none of those 168 get to just hang out there and wait and be courted, you know, for example, by candidates as we go into the convention. They've all been apportioned in some manner. And here in New Hampshire, we are a proportional state. Every candidate that received 10% or more of the vote, you know, got a proportional amount of delegates, and the Secretary of State will assign those three at-large delegates, the committeewoman, committeeman, and chairman, proportionally.
So, and I want to ask you, Jennifer, if I could please, about this 10% popular vote threshold rule, since you mentioned it, when it comes to the delegate tally. Now, most states have this. In fact, a lot of states have more than 10%.
Right.
But this was an eye-opener for me. Just explain how this works.
Well, you know, it's really important to us here in New Hampshire that, you know, when you kind of think about what's at the core, what it's all about in New Hampshire to begin with, what is the first in the nation you know, tradition about. It's about giving everybody a chance to come here and make their argument and possibly, you know, sway and win the support of voters across our state. And so, you know, we're really very pleased to have a lower threshold. We think that that's fair. And we've tried to be, as we've gone through this process, and as your guests in the studio, I'm sure, understand, every 4 years you go to convention on both sides of the aisle, and the rules are reexamined and they're changed in some way, and sometimes, you know, big changes, sometimes small changes. But, I believe that this is an appropriate place for us to be, so that when candidates come here and they work hard and they earn that, you know, bit of the vote, they get their delegates and they have the opportunity to move on to future states if they so choose. So what we see is being the difference now between, and far be it from me to suggest that the Democratic Party should do everything the way the Republican Party does it. However, what we see is being a dramatic difference here. The super delegates, as opposed to the at-large delegates, have significant sway over who the nominee becomes. And it just so happens that the results here in New Hampshire created a real magnifying glass on the disparity and what I've called the very undemocratic process of the Democratic Party.
And we'll definitely talk about that with Ray Buckley. He's going to be joining us a little bit later. So just to clarify this 10% threshold, so Donald Trump, the big winner here in New Hampshire, he gets his own duly won delegates based on his popular vote. Mm-hmm. But now he also gets the delegates, or at least the vote tally leading to delegates, for Fiorina, Ron Paul, Chris Christie, and anybody else who got less than 10%. So added up, that's a big boost for Mr. Trump.
I think Mr. Trump is – I haven't seen the exact final numbers. I haven't gotten an official report from the Secretary of State's office, but I believe that Mr. Trump is at 10 delegates. I don't want to say that in blood, but that's where I think that we are.
Yeah.
And I think again that proportional distribution of delegates is a fair way to keep, you know, to move the process forward. I appreciate that you'll have the opportunity to discuss the difference between the two when Mr. Buckley comes on, but I'm suspecting he will not highlight the difference, you know, the fact being that these superdelegates on the Democrat side, you know, when you look at the difference between the votes, let's say Bernie Sanders won by 40,000 votes more than Hillary Clinton, each one of those superdelegates is going to carry the weight of 10,000 New Hampshire voters when you go into the convention. I don't think there's even an attempt there to try to be fair and make sure that the people's voice is heard in the process. That is, it's like the living, breathing example of establishment taking over and deciding who the nominee is going to be.
Well, and that's why we're looking at this hour, because there has been a lot of consternation. But I did want to highlight also, mm-hmm. again, some of the rules on your side, Jennifer Horn. And I really I appreciate you being with us today. It's confusing. Thank you for helping us untangle a little bit.
I do appreciate the opportunity. I hope everybody has a great day.
Take care. That's Jennifer Horn. Again, she's chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party. The phone number for you to join us here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Chris Galdieri, this threshold rule that you have to, you know, so Donald Trump gets even a bigger boost here in New Hampshire. He gets all those votes that were cast for Fiorina and so forth. We should say that Democrats have this as well, this threshold rule.
That's right. And in some states, it's even higher than 10%. And this can lead to all sorts of, you know, strategic considerations by campaigns, counterintuitive outcomes. The example that came to mind when we were discussing this earlier was in 2008 in the Nevada caucus. If you looked at the raw vote total, Barack Obama lost to Hillary Clinton. If you looked at the delegate count, Barack Obama beat Hillary Clinton. And that just came
wow.
down to which districts his voters were in and the margins he had won by. So, you know, smart campaigns are aware of this and they incorporate that into how they're approaching their strategic and tactical thinking.
What about the threshold rule, Ken Rudin? So let's say Carly Fiorina wins 9.9% of the vote here in New Hampshire. Her votes still go to Donald Trump. That's probably pretty upsetting for Fiorina supporters.
Well, of course, I don't know how many Fiorina supporters there are left once a candidate gets out of the race. But expanding on what Chris just said, I mean, here's a perfect example of Iowa in 2008 when Chris Dodd, I mean, if you look at Chris Dodd and Joe Biden, at the end of the night, they had 1% of the caucus supporters, even though, I mean, if you looked at the polls, they were running 15-20% of the polls. But because of the way the caucus roll or have that threshold of 15%. And so as it turned out, Chris Dodd and Joe Biden wound up with 1% of the Iowa votes, even though if you looked at their supporters around the state, it was much, much higher. The caucus rules are much more different. Ron Paul won in many states, in caucus states, even though he may have lost the caucus vote, but because of succeeding rounds, state conventions, county conventions, district conventions, their supporters can pack those conventions. A lot of times, the caucus results are not reflected in what happens with the actual district, delegate distribution.
Wow. Well, the more you look into
it. Wait, was that the most confusing thing?
Yeah, you've ever? It is confusing, but it's really, the more you look into the system, the more you realize there are all these little rules at the state level, even the county level, as Chris said. With us now, gentlemen, is Ray Buckley. Again, he's chair of the New Hampshire Democratic Party. And Ray Buckley, good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, what's your message, Ray, to those Democrats who've been signing petitions, definitely sending us email, up in arms over the superdelegates and the seeming unfairness to Bernie Sanders, who won by a landslide here?
Well, as you have noted, Bernie Sanders hasn't said anything about this process because he certainly understands that this is the process. And Tad Devine, his senior advisor, is the architect of this plan. And Tad was the delegate person for Mondale, for Dukakis, for Bob Kerry, and for other candidates over the years. You know, this will be the ninth nominating process that we've had superdelegates. Here in New Hampshire, there have been 50 superdelegates, 80% of which have endorsed a candidate pre-primary. No superdelegate has ever switched their allegiances right after the primary to support a winner of the primary. But New Hampshire superdelegates have always gone with the nominee, no matter who won New Hampshire or who they support in the primary.
So those
this
people
delegate
who are
selection process has been a very open process. A draft was presented to the 240 member of the New Hampshire State Committee, posted for 30 days on our website for public input, receiving a lot of input from the public. We also put many postings on social media. It was approved by the DNC in June. And since then, we've had 19 trainings on the process. We conducted in every corner of the state. Over 1,000 activists attended these trainings that were conducted by myself personally or the state party staff. And we had a presentation at our convention that attracted over 4,000 people. And on Saturday,
so
January 30th, hold on.
What's the point that you're trying to make by telling us about all this outreach and training that you've been trying to do?
What I'm saying is that the fact that you even had Jennifer Horn on here to talk about the Republican process, this was something that was stirred up by the Republicans and some members of the media. This is something that the New Hampshire Democratic activists, we reached out on Saturday, January 30th. We had 1,000 New Hampshire Democrats got together to create the delegate slates, all of which this process was explained to. You know, the vast majority of our delegates are first-time delegates. They're offering a tremendous diversity of people of color, very young, seniors, gays, economic diversity, and divided evenly by gender. You look at what's happening on the Republican side, what Jennifer Warren failed to say is that each candidate handpicks their delegates. In convention after convention, it's almost uniformly straight, white, middle-aged men. There are very few women that are ever selected as delegates to part of their delegation.
So, wait, Ray,
been a person of color.
Are you suggesting that MoveOn.org is, you know, being pushed by Republicans to do all this online petitioning? I mean, are you suggesting that Democrats aren't really the people who are upset about this?
I'm talking about New Hampshire Democrats, thousands and thousands of New Hampshire Democrats that have been educated and informed on this process. This is a process, as I said, that's been occurring for multiple, now nearly 40 years, for over 32 years that we've had the same process. It's never resulted in the change of who the nomination is. And when we've taken the time to explain this to folks that are new to the process over the last week, they've left satisfied with the conversation. So
your message to people who might be upset, Ray, is, look, in the end, the superdelegates will support the nominee. That's the bottom line?
The bottom line is, as the result of the primary, Bernie Sanders has 15 delegates from New Hampshire and Hillary Clinton has 9 delegates from New Hampshire. No vote is going to happen until the last week of July in Philadelphia. New Hampshire superdelegates have always gone with the nominee. If Bernie Sanders is the likely nominee, we will all support Bernie Sanders. If Hillary Clinton is the likely nominee, we will all go with Hillary Clinton. Every single convention, we've uniformly gone with the nominee. And that's exactly what's going to happen again. And there's absolutely zero. If there was a real need for concern, you don't think that Bernie Sanders would be talking about this?
Every few elections, Ray, this whole question of delegates comes up in 2000, 2008. Here's a broader question for you, Ray, please. Why not just get rid of this whole system and let the people choose the president directly? Why do we need thresholds and delegates and proportionality and winner-take-all and so forth?
Well, that's the same sort of argument that you hear about getting rid of the New Hampshire primary, which, you know, is absolutely foolish. The fact is that we have a process that's worked very well since 1832 when we had our first convention. By the way, the first national convention with delegates was by New Hampshire state statute passed by the Democratic legislature here in New Hampshire. And the first Democratic convention was held in first national convention of any party was held in 1832 in Baltimore, and it was convened by a New Hampshire Democrat. So we're very proud of the process. A lot of people have argued against having the conventions, but the fact is that they play a very important role. We believe the people that the process of having to go through, you talk to every single person who's been elected president in the last 40 years or longer, they've gone through the process of having to campaign in Iowa and in New Hampshire and now Nevada and South Carolina, and they're going to say that their presidency was stronger because of that, because they actually had to go into living rooms. They had to go into the street corners and the town hall meetings and have all those sorts of conversations that you just simply couldn't if you just had a national primary that occurred. It would simply be whoever the best known person was or whoever had the most amount of money.
Now, that's Bernie interesting. That's an argument in favor of, you know, this whole sort of confused state by state, county by county system of delegates and so forth. Ray, in the interest of time, I have to let you go. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, the exchange number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Chris and Ken, boy, I've got lots of calls and emails, including some folks who think that superdelegates are a good idea. But Ken, I'd like your thoughts on that last point that Ray made. You know, some people are saying, and this happens every 4 years, you know, get rid of the Electoral College, get rid of this incredibly arcane, confusing delegate system. Ray made the point, yeah, but then the other side is it just becomes a, you know, sort of a popularity contest.
Well, there's so many things that Ray said that I would love to comment on. I mean, first of all, if we can start from the beginning, talking about blaming the Republicans in the media, I'm just saying, look, yes, Bernie Sanders has not commented on this, but if I'm Bernie Sanders and I win 60% of the vote in New Hampshire, and I see that Ann Custer and Billy Shaheen and Gene Shaheen and Maggie Hassan and Kathy Sullivan are all Clinton delegates, you start to think that, oh my goodness, the system is rigged against us. But the point that Ray makes, which is absolutely valid, that ultimately by the time we get to the convention, there more often than not the party wounds, the party divisions have healed, and they will unite behind one candidate. But again, if you're talking about what's going on right now, when Bernie Sanders is trying to break out with some momentum, and he looks at the numbers that came out of New Hampshire regarding the popular vote and the delegate vote, that says that something's wrong with this system.
Well, here's two emails in favor of superdelegates. So I'm going to read these, and then after a short break, we'll go to our listeners. Here's one from Robin, who says the superdelegate system is intended to provide the party with some adult supervision. Robin says, if only the Republicans had superdelegates, the party would avoid the approaching disaster, Robin says, called Donald Trump. And then we have an email here from Richard, who says superdelegates are good for the little political process in this age of big money, super PACs influencing nominations and elections. The superdelegates could serve as a fair assurance that will avoid super PAC influence. We'll talk about that after a break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the dust-up over delegates. It's a primer on the presidential nominating process. Let's hear from you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. And Chris Galdieri, Ken Rudin, let's go to the phones. And Josh is in Manchester. Hi, Josh. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. I agree that these superdelegates are not going to really affect the outcome at the convention. They're not going to risk – the establishment of the Democratic Party aren't going to risk the party going into the general election divided. But I will say why I disagree with Ray Buckley, and I think that they do matter, is that it's going to discourage a lot of first-time voters who are seeing that Bernie Sanders came out with the popular vote and still left New Hampshire with less delegates. It's going to discourage them in other states to come out and vote.
So there's a psychological effect, you're saying, Josh.
Yeah, I think that's going to really discourage young voters who would otherwise come out for Bernie Sanders, and it's going to help the establishment candidate Hillary Clinton in the long run.
Josh, thank you for calling in. What do you think, Chris?
I suppose it's possible, but I think if you look at the message of the Sanders campaign, I think, you know, this could fit right into that. If his argument is that the economy is rigged, if he says that the nomination is rigged too, well, unless you come out and vote for me, Bernie Sanders, I think I could see that being incorporated into his campaign message pretty easily.
Ken, do you want to jump in there?
I agree exactly with what Chris just said. But I mean, clearly that it might even incite the Sanders supporters to make it sure that they do come out in subsequent states. And I know we're spending a lot of time focusing on New Hampshire. But of course, if Hillary Clinton wins in Nevada, in South Carolina, in Super Tuesday states, then a lot of this conversation might be very moot.
Yeah, after March 1st, when all those votes start coming in, the conversation could shift or not, Ken. It could be neck and neck. What did you think, Ken, about the email I read just before the break from Richard, who saw superdelegates as sort of a way to counter the influence of big money? Again, to quote Richard, the superdelegates serve as a fair assurance that will avoid super PAC influence, providing checks and balances to the nominating process. What do you think, Ken?
Well, I don't see any limitation of super PAC money coming into the 2016 campaign on either side of the aisle. If anything, I mean, it makes Bernie Sanders' argument even more that the establishment and the system is part of is big money. And so I don't see that superdelegates limiting that. But I do see, given what's happening in the Republican Party, I would just suspect that with somebody like Donald Trump just winning despite the influence of the party insiders, whether there will be some major rules changes for 2020.
Okay. Thank you for that call, Josh. And let's go next to Linda in Newfields. Hi, Linda. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Thank you very much for taking my call, Laura.
Sure.
I am decades ago, I was a government major at AU. And I worked for a senator that Dan has mentioned, Senator Clifford Case. And that was a time in our political history where people got along, even though they were different. And they were not so polarized in that they were not completely all Republicans on the right and all the Democrats on the left, even though that's not exactly true. But in this presidential campaign, that's the way it's appearing. So I'm in favor of the superdelegates to add some degree of sanity. And because if a far-right candidate like Trump gets the Republican nod and Bernie Sanders gets the Democratic nod, our usual format after a convention to get to the middle is impossible because these people have struck extreme views. So I guess my point is I am terrified at what is currently going on, and I pray that the stability of the RNC and DNC will hold so we get a leveling so that average Americans don't have to decide from one end of the other on a political spectrum who to vote for. I mean, and then the thought of one of these people on far right or far left becoming president, how effective will they be since their ties do not really rely on a party structure?
Well, Linda, thank you. Yeah.
I'm knowing what your thoughts are on it, particularly since...
Thank you for calling in, Linda. Yeah, so Ken Rudin, another voice, in addition to those two emails I read, in favor of superdelegates. Now, the vast majority of our listeners, at least through Facebook, email, phone calls, have told us they don't like this system. But there's Linda joining Richard and Robin saying, providing some measure of stability.
Well, let me just a quick history lesson. I don't want to bore anybody, but Linda talks about Clifford Case. Clifford Case was a moderate Republican senator from New Jersey, elected four terms to the U.S. Senate. When he was defeated in 1978 by a very strong conservative in the Republican primary, New Jersey has not elected a Republican senator since then. So the party really has, once upon a time, you could disagree with, you could be a liberal Republican Republican or a conservative Democrat and survive. There were more Joe Lieberman's, there were more Clifford Cates cases back in the day. Now, as Linda points out, the two extremes of the party, I mean, I'm not going to say that Bernie Sanders is extreme or even Donald Trump is extreme, but there are extremes in the party that are pulling the two parties further and further apart. And so the argument for superdelegates, or at least some adult supervision, is that, look, the name of the game is winning and not to prove an ideological point. And maybe we need those adults to bring some sanity to the two parties.
Linda, thank you for the call. Again, the phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go next to Nashua. Chris is on the air. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking the call.
Go ahead, yeah.
I've always felt that it's interesting how the founders, the framers of the Constitution, had a fundamental disrespect for the direct democracy concept. I know you've mentioned this already, but, you know, we have the Electoral College to elect the president, not direct vote. We have the Senate to affirm and consent on Supreme Court justices, not direct vote, much to the chagrin of McConnell and others. And so I think the idea that somehow democracy is denied if we don't have direct apportionment of voting of delegates, I think that's a bit far-fetched. You know, I think the founders would fundamentally agree with the idea that there are some delegates whose opinions should count more than others because they built that into the system. And so, you know, if the Republican Party in particular, you know, wanted to really take their idea of direct apportionment to the extreme, they would just do away with delegates and just have direct votes that some clerk just adds up at a convention and says, this is the candidate, you know.
Chris, earlier we talked to Ray Buckley about, you know, just getting rid of this whole system altogether. And he said, no, because then it becomes sort of, you know, who has the biggest name recognition, who has the most money and so forth. So are you suggesting getting rid of all the delegates or just changing the system?
Oh, no, I personally like the idea of delegates, and I personally think that some delegates' votes should count more than others. What I'm saying is for especially Jennifer Horne to defend on this idea of direct democracy, it's not really what they have, because if they really wanted that, they would just do away with the delegate idea and risk having the passions of the masses drive their candidate. But it's interesting that they didn't do that, that they still have the idea of delegates, presumably to safeguard against some outcome that could possibly be so extreme that I guess the will of the voters would have to be checked.
Okay. Chris, thank you very much. You know, this gets back to almost our founding fathers, right, Chris Galdieri? I mean, what would they think of all this?
I think they'd be very confused. You know, one of the issues that came up early in American history is, okay, we've got the Electoral College to pick presidents. It turns out the Electoral College didn't work very well as it was originally designed. You had a tie vote in the Electoral College in 1800, so they tweaked it. And then once parties developed, the question was, well, how do parties pick their candidates? So some people would be nominated by state legislatures, some would be nominated by their congressional parties. So the conventions, you know, were far from the first attempt at figuring this out. And I think what we see going on now is, you know, we have the system that was basically designed in the early 19th century that we're trying to update to 21st century expectations and norms about democracy and participation. And it's, you know, it's a tough fit. You know, it's like an addition that's been built onto a very old house. And, and you're just trying to get everything to work together. And sometimes that's not going to be the case.
Sometimes the floor sags
exactly,
in ways you
exactly.
didn't expect. That's a really good analogy, actually.
I just came up with it. It's pretty good. I should write that down.
Here's an email from Jesse in Dover who says, this is just like the Electoral College conundrum, where the voting will of the people can potentially be overruled, as has happened in presidential elections at least twice. Jesse says many people don't feel that their vote really counts with such a potentially rigged system. And here's a Facebook comment from Ginny, who says, as a Democrat who worked hard for Bernie Sanders' win in New Hampshire, she says, I would like to see the popular vote be the final vote and do away with delegates and the Electoral College. So here's the two questions Ginny asks. And Ginny, thank you. She says, number one, what needs to be done at the state level to make this happen? And number two, what needs to be done at the national level to make this happen? So we keep going back to this point, Ken Rudin. You know, it's so confusing. People definitely have their concerns. And people like Ginny say, what do we need to do to get rid of this?
Keep dreaming, maybe, because first of all, I mean, you'll need constitutional amendments to go from Electoral College to the popular vote. Let me just say a few things. First of all, in 1972, Hubert Humphrey got more votes than George McGovern in the primary system, but because McGovern picked up far more delegates, he became the nominee. Now, if Hubert Humphrey was the nominee in 1972 because he had the most votes, well, the McGovern people would say, well, this is rigged. This is the party stealing the nomination away from us, even though Humphrey got the most votes. So be careful what you wish for. If we got rid of the Electoral College, then forget about anybody caring about swing states like New Hampshire or Virginia or Nevada or Iowa. Everybody would just stay in New York, Texas, Florida, Ohio, and California, and the rest of the states would never see a presidential candidate again.
Because it would just be all about the raw numbers.
The most votes. And could we just say one thing we haven't got a chance to say? Regarding the Democratic and Republican way of choosing delegates in the primaries, the Democrats throughout the whole process are proportional. It's the proportional, that's how you allocate the delegates in the primaries. For the Republicans, it's proportional until March 14th. All the primaries and caucuses afterwards, it's winner take all. So if a lot of candidates stay in the race and Donald Trump, let's say, keeps winning because the opposition is split, Donald Trump theoretically could win every delegate in those winner take all states after March 14th. This is not what the Republican establishment wanted when they devised this system, but it sure could be the result.
Yeah, that winner take all. That's an important point, Ken. Now, here in New Hampshire, it's proportional. So if I win, right, 45% of the vote and Chris Galdieri wins 55%, then we each get almost half. Chris gets a little more than me. If we move to another state later in the nomination process, I get 45%. Chris gets 55%. Chris gets all the delegates.
But you should get the most delegates because it's your show.
But that does strike some people, Chris. I mean, it's kind of unfair. I came almost as close as you.
Yeah, no, that's a fair criticism. I think what we run into when we look at these things really closely is there's no really perfect way to translate popular sentiment into votes or delegates or anything. I mean, even if you just went to a direct popular vote for nominees and president, you still have the argument that President Obama made the day after the 2014 election, which is, well, I represent all the American people, including the two-thirds who didn't vote. And I think that means that there's necessarily going to be, somebody is going to feel like they've had their ox gored or that they've just been treated unfairly just because no system is going to be perfect.
Well, and we've talked a lot this hour about Democrats, especially because of the superdelegates and a lot of the upset there. And we've looked at this system broadly. But I did want to focus on the Republicans a little bit more with just the few minutes that we have left. Ken Rudin, I'm looking at a headline from Politico, and it says, campaigns, meaning Republican campaigns, secretly prep for brokered GOP convention. Now, still very early. Who knows what's going to happen on Super Tuesday? But how much are you hearing about the idea that if it does look like Donald Trump is racking up all these nominees, that the Republican establishment will make one last gasp effort at the convention to say no?
Well, that's, that first, it's a political junkie's dream to have a brokered convention. The last time Republicans went to more than one ballot at their convention was 1948, when Thomas Dewey won the nomination on the third ballot. So that hasn't happened in a long, long time. But the difference is, while the Democratic delegates are advised to support the nominees who won their states and districts, the Republican delegates are pledged, bound and pledged for the first ballot. So if there is a brokered convention on the Republican side, it would have to be after the first ballot, because right now on the first ballot, all these delegates are pledged to who won their districts and states.
So they are, as Jennifer Horn told us, bound and pledged to follow the will of the people in those states on the first ballot.
Right.
Then what, Ken?
Well, then if you still don't have the majority needed to win the nomination, then there's a lot of wheeling and dealing. I mean, we're talking about something that hasn't happened in more than 65 years. It's remarkable that, once upon a time, these conventions mattered, the battles over the nomination and the trading of delegates. But right, we haven't seen in either party since, I guess, well, the Democrats in 1952 went to a third ballot, Republicans 1948. But with so much of the establishment not in favor of Donald Trump, and yet Donald Trump is leading in almost every state I've seen in subsequent states. Boy, that Republican convention, which is usually a snoozer. I mean, I remember the big story about the 2000 convention was how long Al Gore and Tipper Gore would be kissing. That was the big issue at the convention. But right now, this could be big stuff at a convention.
Well, and Chris, what are you going to be looking at in the weeks ahead, especially with all these votes coming up, in terms of this whole, you know, way that delegates are handed out?
I'm going to be looking at vote totals in the different states. I think we might find ourselves in a situation where we're looking at who the delegates are for each candidate, trying to figure out if these are people who might be in play on a second ballot and that sort of thing. And I'll be looking at endorsements. Are people like Nikki Haley coming out for specific candidates as she did for Marco Rubio? One point to bear in mind with the idea of a brokered convention, we call it that, but we have to remember there aren't brokers anymore. Back in the 40s, when you had one of these conventions, delegates were controlled by state party leaders who could say, all right, boys, I've talked to Governor Warren, and we're going to get behind him. And if you don't want to be on board with that, then your cousin who I got a job is going to be out of work or something like that. There's nobody in that position anymore. If this goes to a second ballot, those delegates will basically be free agents. And it will be epic if it happens, which means it probably won't.
All right. Both of you, thank you so much. Lots more to untangle, but we'll close it out there. Chris Galdieri, thank you so much for coming in.
Always happy to be here.
Chris Galdieri, assistant professor of politics at St. Anselm College, specializing in presidential politics. Ken Rudin, thank you also for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
Ken Rudin, host of The Political Junkie, a weekly radio show covering national, state, and local politics. You can find him at krpoliticaljunkie.com. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel, with help from Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.